He moved constantly from one foot to another, the impish dance that children learn from war, the simplest version of being on your guard.
First, bubblegum, mister.
Tell me where you got this. I warn you not to play the fool with me. Samad made a grab for the boy and caught him by the arm of his shirt. He tried desperately to wriggle free. The boy's friends began to slink off, deserting their quickly sinking champion. Did you kill a man for this? A vein in Samad's forehead was fighting passionately to escape his skin. He wished to defend a country that wasn't his and revenge the killing of men who would not have acknowledged him in a civilian street. Archie was amazed. It was his country. In his small, cold-blooded, average way, he was one of the many essential vertebrae in its backbone. Yet he could feel nothing comparable for it.
No, mister, no, no, from him. Him!
He stretched his free arm and pointed to a large derelict house that sat like a fat brooding hen on the horizon. Did someone in that house kill our men? Barked Samad.
What you say, mister? Squeaked the boy.
Who is there?
He is a doctor. He is there, but sick. Can't move. Doctor sick.
A few remaining children excitedly confirmed the name.
Doctor sick. Mister. Doctor sick.
What's wrong with him? The boy, now enjoying the attention, theatrically mimed a man crying. English? Like us? German? French? Bulgarian? Greek? Samad released the boy, tired from the misplaced energy.
He no one. He doctor sick only, said the boy dismissively. Bubblegum.
A few days later, and still no help had arrived. The strain of having to be continually at war in such a pleasant village began to pull at Archie and Samad, and, bit by bit, they relaxed more and more into a kind of civilian life. Every evening they ate dinner in the old man Gozan's kitchen café. Watery soup cost 5 cigarettes each. Any kind of fish cost a low-ranking bronze medal. As Archie was now wearing one of Dickinson Smith's uniforms, his own having fallen apart, he had a few of the dead man's medals to spare, and with them purchased other niceties and necessities, coffee, soap, chocolate. For some pork, Archie handed over a fag card of Dorothy L'Amour that had been pressed against his arse in his back pocket ever since he joined up. Go on, Sam. We'll use them as tokens like food stamps. We can buy them back when we have the means, if you like. I'm a Muslim, said Samad, pushing a plate of pork away, and my Rita Hayworth leaves me only with my own soul.
Why don't you eat it? Said Archie, guzzling his two chops down like a madman. Strange business, if you ask me.
I don't eat it for the same reason you as an Englishman will never truly satisfy a woman.
Why's that? Said Archie, pausing from his feast.
It's in our cultures, my friend. He thought for a minute, maybe deeper, maybe in our bones.
After dinner, they would make a pretense of scouring the village for the killers, rushing through the town, searching the same 3 disreputable bars and looking in the back bedrooms of pretty women's houses. But, after a time, this too was abandoned, and they sat instead smoking cheap cigars outside the tank, enjoying the lingering crimson sunsets and chatting about their previous incarnations as newspaper boy, Archie, and biology student, Samad. They knocked around ideas that Archie did not entirely understand, and Samad offered secrets into the cool night that he had never spoken out loud. Long, comfortable silences passed between them like those between women who have known each other for years. They looked out onto stars that lit up unknown country, but neither man clung particularly to home. In short, it was precisely the kind of friendship an Englishman makes on holiday that he can make only on holiday. A friendship that crosses class and colour, a friendship that takes as its basis physical proximity and survives because the Englishman assumes the physical proximity will not continue. A week and a half since the radio had been repaired, and there was still no reply to the aid signals they sent bouncing along the airwaves in search of ears to hear them. By now, the village knew the war was over, but they felt disinclined to reveal the fact to their 2 visitors, whose daily bartering had proved such a boost to the local economy. In the stretches of empty time, Archie would lever up sections of the wheel track with an iron pole, while Samad investigated the problem. Across continents, both men's families presumed them dead. "Is there a woman that you have back in Brighton City?" asked Samad, anchoring his head between the lion jaws of track and tank. Archie was not a good-looking boy. He was dashing if you took a photo and put your thumb over his nose and mouth, but otherwise he was quite unremarkable. Girls would be attracted to his large, sad Sinatra blue eyes, but then be put off by the Bing Crosby ears and the nose that ended in a natural onion bulb swelling like W.C. Fields. "A few," he said nonchalantly. "You know, we were in there. You?" "A young lady has already been picked out for me. A Miss Begum, daughter of Mr. and Mrs. Begum, the in-laws, as you say. Dear God, those two are so far up the rectums of the establishment in Bengal that even the Lord Governor sits sniveling, waiting for his mullah to come in carrying a dinner invitation from them." Samad laughed loudly and waited for company, but Archie, not understanding a word, stayed poker-faced as usual. "Oh, they are the best people," continued Samad, only slightly dispirited. "The very best people. Extremely good blood. And, as an added bonus, there is a propensity amongst their women, traditionally throughout the ages, you understand, for really enormous melons." Samad performed the necessary mime, and then returned his attention to realigning each tooth of track with its appropriate groove. "And?" asked Archie. "And what?" "Are they?" Archie repeated the mime, but this time with the kind of anatomical exaggeration that leaves air-traced women unable to stand upright. "Oh, but I still have some time to wait," he said, smiling wistfully. "Unfortunately, the Begum family do not yet have a female child of my generation."
"You mean your wife's not bloody born yet?"
"What of it?" asked Samad, pulling a cigarette from Archie's top pocket. He scratched a match along the side of the tank and lit it. Archie wiped the sweat off his face with a greasy hand. "Where I come from," said Archie, "a bloke likes to get to know a girl before he marries her. Where you come from, it is customary to boil vegetables until they fall apart. This does not mean," said Samad tersely, "that it is a good idea." Their final evening in the village was absolutely dark, silent. The muggy air made it unpleasant to smoke, so Archie and Samad tapped their fingers on the cold stone steps of a church, for lack of other hand employment. For a moment, in the twilight, Archie forgot the war that had actually ceased to exist anyway. A past-tense, future-perfect kind of night. It was while they were still innocent of peace, during this last night of ignorance, that Samad decided to cement his friendship with Archie. Often this is done by passing on a singular piece of information, some sexual peccadillo, some emotional secret or obscure hidden passion that the reticence of new acquaintance has prevented being spoken. But for Samad, nothing was closer or meant more to him than his blood. It was natural then, as they sat on holy ground, that he should speak of what was holy to him. And there was no stronger evocation of the blood that ran through him, and the ground which that blood had stained over the centuries, than the story of his great-grandfather. So Samad told Archie the much-neglected, 100-year-old mildewed yarn of Mangal Pandey. "So he was your grandfather," said Archie, after the tale had been told, the moon had passed behind clouds and he had been suitably impressed. "Your real blood grandfather, great-grandfather." "Well, that is something. Do you know, I remember it from school. I do. History of the colonies, Mr. Juggs, bald, bug-eyed, nasty old duffer. Mr. Juggs, I mean, not your grandfather. Got the message through, though. Even if it took a ruler to the back of your hand, you know, you still hear people in the regiments calling each other pandies, you know, if the bloke's a bit of a rebel. I never thought where it came from. Pandey was the rebel. Didn't like the English. Shot the first bullet of the mutiny. I remember it now, clear as a bell. And that was your grandfather. Great-grandfather. Well, well, that's something, isn't it?" said Archie, placing his hands behind his head and lying back to look at the stars. "To have a bit of history in your blood like that motivates you, I'd imagine. I'm a Jones, you see. It's like a Smith. We're nobody. My father used to say, we're the chaff, boy. We're the chaff. Not that I've ever been much bothered, mind. Proud all the same, you know. Good, honest English stock. but in your family you had a hero.
Samad puffed up with pride. Yes, Archibald, that is exactly the word. Naturally, you will get these petty English academics trying to discredit him because they cannot bear to give an Indian his due, but he was a hero, and every act I have undertaken in this war has been in the shadow of his example.
That's true, you know, said Archie thoughtfully. They don't speak well about Indians back home.
They certainly wouldn't like it if you said an Indian was a hero. Everybody would look at you a bit funny.
Suddenly, Samad grabbed his hand. It was hot, almost fevered, Archie thought. He'd never had another man grab his hand. His first instinct was to move or punch him or something, but then he reconsidered because Indians were emotional, weren't they? All that spicy food and that.
Please, do me this one great favor, Jones. If ever you hear anyone when you are back home, if we get back to our respective homes, if ever you hear anyone speak of the East, and here his voice plummeted a register, and the tone was full and sad.
Hold your judgment. If you are told they are all this, or they do this, or their opinions are these, withhold your judgment until all the facts are upon you. Because that land they call India goes by a thousand names and is populated by millions, and if you think you have found two men the same amongst that multitude, then you are mistaken. It is merely a trick of the moonlight.
Samad released his hand and rummaged in his pocket, dabbing his finger into a repository of white dust he kept in there, slipping it discreetly into his mouth. He leant against the wall and drew his fingertips along the stone. It was a tiny missionary church, converted into a hospital, and then abandoned after 2 months when the sound of shells began to shake the windowsills. Samad and Archie had taken to sleeping there because of the thin mattresses and the large, airy windows. Samad had taken an interest too, due to loneliness, he had told himself, due to melancholy, in the powdered morphine to be found in stray storage cabinets throughout the building, hidden eggs on an addictive Easter trail. Whenever Archie went to piss or to try the radio once more, Samad roved up and down his little church, looting cabinet after cabinet, like a sinner moving from confessional to confessional. Then, having found his little bottle of sin, he would take the opportunity to rub a little into his gums or smoke a little in his pipe, and then lay back on the cool terracotta floor, looking up into the exquisite curve of the church dome. It was covered in words, this church. Words left 300 years earlier by dissenters, unwilling to pay a burial tax during a cholera epidemic. Locked in the church by a corrupt landlord and left to die in there. But not before they covered every wall with letters to family, poems, statements of eternal disobedience. Samad liked the story well enough when he first heard it, but it only truly struck him when the morphine hit. Then every nerve in his body would be alive, and the information, all the information contained in the universe, all the information on walls would pop its cork and flow through him like electricity through a ground wire. Then his head would open out like a deck chair, and he would sit in it a while and watch his world go by. Tonight, after just more than enough, Samad felt particularly lucid, like his tongue was buttered and like the world was a polished marble egg. And he felt a kinship with the dead dissenters. They were Pandey's brothers. Every rebel, it seemed to Samad tonight, was his brother. He wished he could speak with them about the mark they made on the world. Had it been enough? When death came, was it really enough? Were they satisfied with the 1,000 words they left behind?
I'll tell you something for nothing, said Archie, following Samad's eyes and catching the church dome's reflection in them. If I'd only had a few hours left, I wouldn't have spent it painting pictures on the ceiling.
Tell me, inquired Samad, irritated to have been dragged from his pleasant contemplation. What great challenge would you undertake in the hours before your death? Unravel Fermat's theorem, perhaps? Master Aristotelian philosophy?
What? Who?
No, I'd, you know, make love. To a lady, said Archie, whose inexperience made him prunish. You know, for the last time.
Samad broke into a laugh. For the first time is more likely.
Oh, go on, I'm serious.
All right. And if there were no ladies in the vicinity?
Well, we can always...
And here, Archie went a pillarbox red, this being his own version of cementing a friendship.
Slap the salami, as the GIs say.
Slap, repeated Samad contemptuously, the salami? And that is it? The last thing you would wish to do before you shuffled off this mortal coil is slap your salami? Achieve orgasm?
Archie, who came from Brighton, where nobody ever, ever said words like orgasm, began to convulse with hysterical embarrassment.
Who is funny? Something is funny? Asked Samad, lighting a fag distractedly despite the heat, his mind carried elsewhere by the morphine.
Nobody, began Archie haltingly. Nothing.
Can't you see it, Jones? Can't you see? Samad lay half in, half out of the doorway, his arms stretched up to the ceiling. The intention? They weren't slapping their salamis, spreading the white stuff. They were looking for something a little more permanent.
I can't see the difference, frankly, said Archie.
When you're dead, you're dead.
Oh, no, Archibald, no, whispered Samad melancholic. You don't believe that. You must live life with the full knowledge that your actions will remain. We are creatures of consequence, Archibald, he said, gesturing to the church walls.
They knew it. My great-grandfather knew it. Some day our children will know it.
Our children, sniggered Archie, simply amused. The possibility of offspring seemed so distant.
Our children will be born of our actions. Our accidents will become their destinies.
Oh, the actions will remain. It is a simple matter of what you will do when the chips are down, my friend, when the fat lady is singing, when the walls are falling in, and the sky is dark, and the ground is rumbling. In that moment, our actions will define us, and it makes no difference whether you are being watched by Allah, Jesus, Buddha, or whether you are not. On cold days, a man can see his breath. On a hot day, he can't. On both occasions, the man breathes.
Do you know, said Archie after a pause, just before I left from Felixstowe, I saw this new drill they have now which breaks in two, and you can put different things on the end, spanner, hammer, even a bottle opener. Very useful in a tight spot, I'd imagine. I'll tell you, I bloody love one of those.
Samad looked at Archie for a moment and then shook his head.
Come on, let's get inside. This Bulgarian food turns my stomach over. I need a bit of sleep.
You look pale, said Archie, helping him up.
It's for my sins, Jones, for my sins, and yet I am more sinned against than sinning.
Samad giggled to himself.
You what?
Archie bore the weight of Samad on one side as they walked inside.
I have eaten something, said Samad, putting on a cut-glass English accent, that is about to disagree with me.
Archie knew very well that Samad sneaked morphine from the cabinets, but he could see Samad wanted him not to know. So, let's get you into bed, was all he said, bringing Samad over to a mattress.
When this is over, we will meet again in England, okay? Said Samad, lunging towards his mattress.
Yes, said Archie, trying to imagine walking along Brighton Pier with Samad.
Because you are a rare Englishman, Sapper Jones. I consider you my friend.
Archie was not sure what he considered Samad, but he smiled gently in recognition of the sentiment.
You will have dinner with my wife and I in the year 1975, when we are big-bellied men sitting on our money mountains, somehow. We will meet.
Archie, dubious of foreign food, smiled weakly.
We will know each other throughout our lives.
Archie laid Samad down, got himself a mattress and maneuvered himself into a position for sleep.
Good night, friend, said Samad, pure contentment in his voice.
In the morning, the circus came to town. Woken by shouts and whooping laughter, Samad struggled into uniform and wrapped one hand around his gun. He stepped into the sun-drenched courtyard to find Russian soldiers in their dun-coloured uniforms leapfrogging over each other, shooting tin cans off each other's heads and throwing knives at potatoes stuck on sticks, each potato sporting a short black twig moustache. With all the exhaustion of revelation, Samad collapsed onto the front steps, sighed, and sat with his hands on his knees, his face turned up towards the heat. A moment later, Archie tripped out, trousers half-mast, waving his gun, looking for the enemy, and shot a frightened bullet in the air. The circus continued without noticing.
Samad pulled Archie wearily by the trouser leg and gestured for him to sit down.
"What's going on?" demanded Archie, watery-eyed.
"Nothing. Nothing absolutely is going on. In fact, it's gone off."
"But these might be the men who..."
"Look at the potatoes, Jones." Archie looked wildly about him.
"What have potatoes got to do with it?"
"They're Hitler potatoes, my friend. They are vegetable dictators, ex-dictators." He pulled one off its stick. "See the little mustaches? It's over, Jones. Someone has finished it for us."
Archie took the potato in his hand.
"Like a bus, Jones. We have missed the bloody war."
Archie shouted over to a lanky Russian in mid-spear of a Hitler potato. "Speak English. How long has it been over?"
"The fighting," he laughed incredulously. 2 weeks, comrade. You will have to go to Japan if you want any more."
"Like a bus," repeated Samad, shaking his head. A great fury was rising in him, bile blocking his throat. This war was to have been his opportunity. He was expected to come home covered in glory, and then to return to Delhi triumphant. When would he ever have another chance? There were going to be no more wars like this one, everybody knew that. The soldier who had spoken to Archie wandered over. He was dressed in the summer uniform of the Russians, the thin material, high-necked collar and oversized floppy cap. He wore a belt around a substantial waist, the buckle of which caught the sun and shot a beam into Archie's eye. When the glare passed, Archie focused on a big, open face, a squint in the left eye, and a head of sandy hair that struck off in several directions. He was altogether a rather jolly apparition on a bright morning, and when he spoke, it was in a fluent American accent in English that lapped at your ears like surf. "The war has been over for 2 weeks, and you are not aware?"
"Our radio, it wasn't..." Archie's sentence gave up on himself. The soldier grinned widely and shook each man's hand vigorously. "Welcome to peacetime, gentlemen. And we thought the Russians were an ill-informed nation." He laughed his big laugh again. Directing his question to Samad, he asked, "Now, where are the rest of you?"
"There is no rest of us, comrade. The rest of the men in our tank are dead, and there is no sign of our battalion."
"You're not here for any purpose?"
No, said Archie, suddenly abashed.
"Purpose, comrade," said Samad, feeling quite sick to his stomach.
"The war is over, and so we find ourselves here quite without purpose."
He smiled grimly and shook the Russian's hand with his good hand.
"I'm going in."
"Son," he said, squinting, "hurts my little peepers. It was nice to have met you."
"Yes, indeed," said the Russian, following Samad with his eyes until he had disappeared into the recesses of the church. Then he turned his attention to Archie.
"Strange guy."
Said Archie.
"Why are you here?" he asked, taking a hand-rolled cigarette the Russian offered him. It turned out the Russian and the 7 men with him were on their way to Poland to liberate the work camps one heard about sometimes in hushed tones. They had stopped here, west of Tokat, to catch themselves a Nazi.
"But there's no one here, mate," said Archie affably. "No one but me and the Indian and some old folk and children from the village. Everyone else is dead or fled."
"Dead or fled. Dead or fled," said the Russian, highly amused, turning a matchstick over and over between his finger and thumb.
"Good phrase, this. Funny phrase. No, well, you see, I would have thought the same, but we have reliable information from your own secret service, in fact, that there is a senior officer at this very moment hiding in that house, there."
He pointed to the house on the horizon.
"The doctor?
Some little lads told us about him. I mean, he must be shitting himself with fear if you lot are after him," said Archie by way of a compliment. "But I'm sure they said he's just some sick bloke. They called him Dr. Sick.
Oi! He ain't English, is he? Traitor or something?"
No. Dr. Marc-Pierre Perret, a young Frenchman, a prodigy, very brilliant. He has worked in a scientific capacity for the Nazis since before the war, on the sterilization program, and later the euthanasia policy. Internal German matters, he was one of the very loyal.
Blimey, said Archie, wishing he knew what it all meant. What's he going to do?
Catch him and take him to Poland, where he will be dealt with by the authorities.
Authorities, said Archie, still impressed but not really paying attention. Blimey.
Archie's attention span was always short, and he had become distracted by the big, amiable Russian's strange habit of looking in two directions at once. "As the information we received was from your secret service, and as you are the highest-ranking officer here, Captain... A glass eye. It was a glass eye, with a muscle behind it that would not behave. "I'm afraid I don't know your name or rank," said the Russian, looking at Archie with one eye, and at some ivy creeping round the church door with the other.
"Oh, me? Jones," said Archie, following the eye's revolving path.
Tree, potato, Archie, potato. "Well, Captain Jones, it would be an honor if you would lead the expedition up the hill."
"Captain, what? Blimey, no, you've got it arseways up," said Archie, escaping the magnetic force of the eye and refocusing on himself, dressed in Dickinson Smith's shiny buttoned uniform.
"I'm not a bloody..." "The lieutenant and I would be pleased to take charge," broke in a voice behind him. "We've been out of the action for quite a while. It is about time we got back in the thick of it, as they say."
Samard had stepped out onto the front steps silently as a shadow, in another of Dickinson Smith's uniforms, and with a cigarette hanging casually off his lower lip, like a sophisticated sentence. He was always a good-looking boy, and, dressed in the shiny buttons of authority, this was only accentuated. In the sharp daylight, framed by the church door, he cut quite an awesome figure.
"What my friend meant," said Samard in his most charming Anglo-Indian lilt, "is that he is not the bloody captain. I am the bloody captain, Captain Samard Iqbal. Comrade Nikolai, Nick Bezotsky."
Samard and the Russian laughed together heartily, shook hands again. Samard lit a cigarette.
"He is my lieutenant, Archibald Jones. I must apologize if I behaved strangely earlier. The food's been disagreeing with me. Now, we'll set off tonight after dark, shall we?"
"Lieutenant?" said Samard, looking at Archie with a private encoded intensity.
"Yes," blurted Archie.
"By the way, comrade," said Samard, striking a match off the wall and lighting up, "I hope you do not mind if I ask, is that a glass eye? It is most realistic."
"Yes, I purchased it in St. Petersburg. I was separated from my own in Berlin. It's a quite incredible likeness, don't you think?"
The friendly Russian popped the eye out of its socket and laid the slimy pearl in his palm for Samard and Archie to see. When the war started, thought Archie, all us boys were crowded around a fag card of Grable's legs. Now the war's ended, we're huddled round some poor bastard's eye. Blimey. For a moment, the eye slid up and down each side of the Russian's hand, then came to a restful halt in the centre of his longish, creased lifeline. It looked up at Lieutenant Archie and Captain Samard with an unblinking stare. That evening, Lieutenant Jones got his first taste of real war. In two army jeeps, Archie, the eight Russians, Gozan the cafe owner, and Gozan's nephew were led by Samard on a mission up the hill to catch a Nazi. While the Russians swigged away at bottles of Sambuca, until not a man among them could remember the first lines of their own national anthem, while Gozan sold roasted chicken pieces to the highest bidders, Samard stood atop the first jeep, high as a kite on his white dust, his arms flailing around, cutting the night into bits and pieces, screaming instructions that his battalion were too drunk to listen to, and he himself was too far gone to understand. Archie sat at the back of the second jeep, quiet, sober, frightened, and in awe of his friend. Archie had never had a hero. He was five when his father went out for a proverbial pack of fags and neglected to return, and, never being much of a reader, the many awful books written to provide young men with fatuous heroes had never crossed his path. No swashbucklers, no one-eyed pirates, no fearless rapscallions for Archie. But Samard, as he stood up there with his shiny officer buttons glistening in the moonlight, like coins in a wishing well, had struck the 17-year-old Archie full square, an uppercut to the jaw that said, "Here is a man for whom no life path is too steep. Here was a raving lunatic standing on a tank. Here was a friend. Here was a hero, in a form Archie had never expected." Three-quarters of the way up, however, the ad hoc road the tanks had been following thinned unexpectedly, forcing the tank to brake suddenly and throwing the heroic captain in a backward somersault over the tank, arse in the air.
"No one comes here for a long, long time," said Gozan's nephew, munching on a chicken bone philosophically. "This,"
He looked at Samad, who had landed next to him, and pointed to the jeep they sat in.
No way.
So, Samad gathered his now paralytic battalion around him and began the march up the mountain in search of a war he could one day tell his grandchildren about, as his great-grandfather's exploits had been told to him. Their progress was hampered by large clods of earth torn from parts of the hill by the reverberation of past bombs and left at intervals along the pathway. From many, the roots of trees shot up impotently and languished in the air. To get by, it was necessary for them to be hacked away with the bayonets of the Russian guns.
"Look like hell,"
snorted Gozan's nephew, drunkenly scrambling through one such set of roots.
"Everything look like hell."
"Pardon him. He feels strongly because he is young. But it is the truth. It was not, how do you say, not argument of ours, Lieutenant Jones," said Gozan, who had been bribed 2 pairs of boots to keep quiet about his friend's sudden rise in rank. "What do we have to do with all this?" He wiped a tear, half inebriated, half overcome with emotion. "What we have to do with? We peaceful people. We don't want to be in war. This hill, once beautiful. Flowers, birds, they were singing, you understand? We are from the east. What have the battles of the west to do with us?"
Instinctively, Archie turned to Samad, expecting one of his speeches. But before Gozan had even finished, Samad had suddenly picked up his pace, and within a minute was running, pushing ahead of the intoxicated Russians who were flailing about with their bayonets. Such was his speed that he was soon out of sight, turning a blind corner and disappearing into the swallowing night. Archie dithered for a few minutes, but then loosened himself from Gozan's nephew's merciless grip. He was just embarking upon the tale of a Cuban prostitute he had met in Amsterdam, and began to run to where he had last seen the flicker of a silver button, another one of the sharp turnings that the mountain path took whenever it liked.
"Captain Inkball! Wait! Captain Inkball!"
He ran on, repeating the phrase, waving his torch, which did nothing but light up the undergrowth in increasingly bizarre anthropomorphisms. Here a man, here a woman on her knees, here 3 dogs howling at the moon. He spent some time like this, stumbling about in the darkness.
"Put your light on! Captain Inkball! Captain Inkball!"
No answer.
"Captain Inkball!"
"Why do you call me that?" said a voice close on his right, "when you know I am no such thing."
Inkball. And as he asked the question, Archie's flash stumbled upon him sitting on a boulder, head in hands.
"Why, I mean, you're not really so much of an idiot, are you? You do know, I presume, you know that I am in fact a private of His Majesty's Army."
"Of course. We have to keep it up, though, don't we? Our cover and that."
"Our cover? Boy..." Samad chuckled to himself in a way that struck Archie as sinister, and when he lifted his head, his eyes were both bloodshot and on the brink of tears.
"What do you think this is? Are we playing silly buggers?"
"No, I...
Are you all right, Sam? You look out of sorts."
Samad was dimly aware that he looked out of sorts. Earlier that evening, he had put a tiny line of the white stuff in the cup of each eyelid. The morphine had sharpened his mind to a knife edge and cut it open. It had been a luscious, eloquent high while it lasted, but then the thoughts thus released had been left to wallow in a pool of alcohol and had landed Samad in a malevolent trough. He saw his reflection this evening, and it was ugly. He saw where he was, at the farewell party for the end of Europe, and he longed for the East. He looked down at his useless hand with its 5 useless appendages, at his skin, burnt to a chocolate brown by the sun. He saw into his brain, made stupid by stupid conversation and the dull stimuli of death, and longed for the man he once was, erudite, handsome, light-skinned Samad Mir. So precious his mother kept him in from the sun's rays, sent him to the best tutors, and covered him in linseed oil 2 times a day.
Sam, you don't look right, Sam. Please, they'll be here in a minute. Sam?
Self-hatred makes a man turn on the first person he sees, but it was particularly aggravating to Samad that this should be Archie, who looked down at him with a gentle concern, with a mix of fear and anger all mingled up in that shapeless face, so ill-equipped to express emotion.
"Don't call me Sam," he growled in a voice Archie did not recognize. "I'm not one of your English matey boys. My name is Samad Mia Iqbal, not Sam, not Sammy, and not, God forbid, Samuel. It is Samad."
Archie looked crestfallen. "Well, anyway," said Samad, suddenly officious and wishing to avoid an emotional scene, "I am glad you are here because I wanted to tell you that I am the worse for wear, Lieutenant Jones. I am, as you say, out of sorts. I am very much the worse for wear." He stood, but then stumbled onto his boulder once more.
"Get up," hissed Archie between his teeth. "Get up. What's the matter with you?"
"It's true. I am very much the worse for the wearing. But I have been thinking," said Samad, taking his gun in his good hand.
"Put that away."
"I have been thinking that I am buggered, Lieutenant Jones. I see no future. I realize this may come as a surprise to you. My upper lip, I'm afraid, is not of the required stiffness. But the fact remains, I see only..."
"Put that away."
"Blackness. I'm a cripple, Jones."
The gun did a merry dance in his good hand as he swung himself from side to side.
"And my faith is crippled. Do you understand? I'm fit for nothing now, not even Allah, who is all-powerful in his mercy. What am I going to do after this war is over? This war that is already over. What am I going to do? Go back to Bengal? Or to Delhi? Who would have such an Englishman there? To England? Who would have such an Indian? They promise us independence in exchange for the men we were. But it is a devilish deal. What should I do? Stay here? Go elsewhere? What laboratory needs one-handed men? What am I suited for?"
"Look, Sam, you're making a fool of yourself."
"Really? And is that how it is to be, friend?" asked Samad, standing, tripping over a stone and colliding back into Archie. "In one afternoon I promote you from private shitbag to lieutenant of the British Army, and this is my thanks. Where are you in my hour of need? Gozan!"
he shouted to the fat cafe owner, who was struggling round the bend at the very back, sweating profusely.
"Gozan, my fellow Muslim, in Allah's name, is this right?"
"Shut up," snapped Archie. "Do you ever want to hear you? Put it down."
Samad's gun arm shot out of the darkness and wrapped itself around Archie's neck, so the gun and both their heads were pressed together in an odious group hug.
"What am I good for, Jones? If I were to pull this trigger, what will I leave behind? An Indian. A turncoat English Indian with a limp wrist like a faggot and no medals that they can ship home with me."
He let go of Archie and grabbed his own collar instead.
"Have some of these, for God's sake," said Archie, taking three from his lapel and throwing them at him. "I've got loads."
"And what about that little matter? Do you realize we're deserters? Effectively deserters? Step back a minute, my friend, and look at us. Our captain is dead. We are dressed in his uniforms, taking control of officers, men of higher rank than ourselves. And how? By deceit. Doesn't that make us deserters?
The war was over. I mean, we made an effort to contact the rest.
Did we, Archie, my friend? Did we? Really? Or did we sit around on our asses like deserters, hiding in a church while the world was falling apart around our ears, while men were dying in the fields?"
They tussled a little as Archie tried to get the gun from him, Samad lashing out at him with not inconsiderable strength. In the distance, Archie could see the rest of their motley crew turn in the corner, a great grey mass in the twilight, pitching from side to side, singing Lydia the Tattooed Lady.
"Look, keep your voice down and calm down," said Archie, releasing him.
"We're imposters. Turncoats in other people's coats.
Did we do our duty, Archibald? Did we? In all honesty,
I have dragged you down with me, Archie, and for that I am sorry. The truth is, this was my fate. This was all written for me long ago.
Oh, Lydia, oh, Lydia, oh, have you met Lydia? Oh, Lydia the tat, oh, lady.
Samad put the pistol absent-mindedly in his mouth and cocked the trigger. Iqbal.
Listen to me, said Archie.
When we were in that tank with the captain, with Roy and the rest.
Oh, Lydia, the queen of tattoos, on her back is the battle of Waterloo. You were always going on about being a hero and all that, like your great uncle, what's his name? Beside it, the wreck of the Hesperus too.
Samad took the gun out of his mouth.
Pandi, he said, great-grandfather, and put the gun back in.
And here it is, a chance. It's staring you in the face. You didn't want to miss the bus, and we're not going to, not if we do this properly. So don't be such a silly fucker about it.
And proudly, above waves, the red, white, and blue, you can learn a lot from Lydia.
Comrade, what in God's name?
Without them noticing, the friendly Russian had ambled up behind them and was looking in horror at Samad, sucking his gun like a lollipop.
Cleaning it, stuttered Samad, clearly shaken, removing the gun from his mouth.
That's how they do it, Archie explained, in Bengal.
The war that 12 men expected to find in the grand old house on the hill, the war that Samad wanted pickled in a jar to hand to his grandchildren as a souvenir of his youth, was not there. Dr. Sick was as good as his name, sitting in an armchair in front of a wood-burning fire, sick, huddled in a rug, pale, very thin, in no uniform, just an open-neck white shirt and some dark-coloured trousers. He was a young man, too, not over 25, and he did not flinch or make any protest when they all burst in, guns at the ready. It was as if they had just dropped in on a pleasant French farmhouse, making the faux pas of coming without invitation and bringing guns to the dinner table. The room was lit entirely by gas lamps in their tiny lady-shaped casings, and the light danced up the wall, illuminating a set of 8 paintings that showed a continuous scene of Bulgarian countryside. In the 5th one, Samad recognized his church, a blip of sandy paint on the horizon. The paintings were placed at intervals and wrapped around the room in a panoramic. Unframed in an mawkish attempt at the modern style, a 9th sat a little too close to the fireplace on an easel, the paint still wet. 12 guns were pointed at the artist, and, when the artist doctor turned to face them, he had what looked like blood-tinged tears rolling down his face. Samad stepped forward. He had had a gun in his mouth and was emboldened by it. He had eaten an absurd amount of morphine, fallen through the hole morphine creates, and survived. You are never stronger, thought Samad as he approached the doctor, than when you land on the other side of despair.
Are you Dr. Perret?
He demanded, making the Frenchman wince at the anglicized pronunciation, sending more bloody tears down his cheeks. Samad kept his gun pointing at him.
Yes, I am he.
What is that in your eyes?
Asked Samad.
I have diabetic retinopathy, monsieur.
What? Asked Samad, still pointing the gun, determined not to undermine his moment of glory with an unheroic medical debate.
It means that when I do not receive insulin, I excrete blood, my friend, through my eyes. It makes my hobby, he gestured at the paintings that surrounded him, not a little difficult. There were to be 10, a 180-degree view. But it seems you have come to disturb me.
He sighed and stood up.
So, are you going to kill me, my friend?
I am not your friend.
No, I do not suppose that you are. But is it your intention to kill me? Pardon me if I say you do not look old enough to squash flies.
He looked at Samad's uniform.
Mon Dieu, you are very young to have got so far in life, Captain.
Samad shifted uncomfortably, catching Archie's look of panic in the corner of his vision. Samad placed his feet a little further apart and stood firm.
I'm sorry if I seem tiresome on this point, but is it your intention, then, to kill me?
Samad's arm stayed perfectly still, the gun unmoving. He could kill him. He could kill him in cold blood. Samad did not need the cover of darkness or the excuse of war.
He could kill him, and they both knew it. The Russian, seeing the look in the Indian's eye, stepped forward. "Pardon me, Captain." Samad remained silent, facing the doctor, so the Russian stepped forward. "We do not have intentions in this matter," said the Russian, addressing Dr. Sik. "We have orders to bring you to Poland." "And there will I be killed?" "That will be for the proper authorities to decide." The doctor cocked his head at an angle and narrowed his eyes.
It is just a thing a man likes to be told. It is curiously significant to a man to be told. It is only polite, at the very least, to be told whether he shall die or whether he shall be spared."
"That will be for the proper authorities to decide," repeated the Russian. Samad walked behind the doctor and stuck the gun into the back of his head. "Walk," he said.
"For the proper authorities to decide." "Isn't peacetime civilized?" remarked Dr. Sik, as a group of 12 men, all pointing guns at his head, led him out of the house.
Later that night, at the bottom of the hill, the battalion left Dr. Sik handcuffed to the jeep and adjourned to the cafe.
"You play poker?" asked a very merry Nikolai, addressing Samad and Archie as they entered the room.
"I'll play anything, me," said Archie.
"The more pertinent question," said Samad, taking his seat with a wry smile, "is, do I play it well?"
"And do you, Captain Iqbal?"
"Like a master," said Samad, picking up the cards dealt to him and fanning them out in his one hand.
"Well," said Nikolai, pouring more sambuca for everyone, "since our friend Iqbal is so confident, it may be best to start relatively small. We'll start with cigarettes, and let's see where that takes us."
Cigarettes took them to medals, which took them to guns, which took them to radios, which took them to jeeps. By midnight, Samad had won 3 jeeps, 7 guns, 40 medals, the land attached to Gozan's sister's house, and an IOU for 4 horses, 3 chickens, and a duck.
"My friend," said Nikolai Pozotsky, his warm, open manner replaced by an anxious gravity, "you must give us a chance to win back our possessions. We cannot possibly leave things as they are."
"I want the doctor," said Samad, refusing to catch the eye of Archibald Jones, who sat open-mouthed and drunk in his chair, "in exchange for the things I have won."
"What on earth for?"
said Nikolai, astonished, leaning back in his chair.
"What possible use?"
"My own reasons. I wish to take him tonight and not be followed, and for the incident to go unreported." Nikolai Pozonsky looked at his hands, looked around the table, and then at his hands once more. Then he reached into his pocket and threw Samad the keys. Once outside, Samad and Archie got into the jeep containing Dr. Sik, who was asleep on the dashboard, started the engine, and drove into the blackness. 30 miles from the village, Dr. Sik woke up to a hushed argument concerning his imminent future.
"But why?" hissed Archie.
"Because, from my point of view, the very problem is that we need blood on our hands, you see?
As an atonement. Do you not see, Jones? We have been playing silly buggers in this war, you and I. There is a great evil that we have failed to fight, and now it is too late. Except we have him, this opportunity. Let me ask you, why was this war fought?"
"Don't talk nonsense," blustered Archie in lieu of an answer.
"So that in the future we may be free. The question was always, what kind of a world do you want your children to grow up in? And we have done nothing. We are at a moral crossroads."
"Look, I don't know what you're on about, and I don't want to know," snapped Archie.
"We're going to dump this one," he motioned to the semi-conscious Sik, "at the first barracks we come across, and then you and me are going our separate ways, and that's the only crossroads I care about."
"What I have realized is that the generations," Samad continued as they sped through miles and miles of unchanging flatlands,
"they speak to each other. Jones, it's not a line. Life is not a line. This is not palm reading. It's a circle, and they speak to us. That is why you cannot read fate. You must experience it."
Samad could feel the morphine bringing the information to him again. All the information in the universe
and all the information on walls in one fantastic revelation.
"Do you know who this man is, Jones?" Samad grabbed the doctor by the back of his hair and bent his neck over the back seat.
"The Russians told me. He's a scientist, like me. But what is his science? Choosing who shall be born and who shall not. Breeding people as if there were so many chickens. Destroying them if the specifications are not correct. He wants to control, to dictate the future. He wants a race of men, a race of indestructible men that will survive the last days of this earth. But it cannot be done in a laboratory. It must be done, it can only be done, with faith. Only Allah saves. I am no religious man. I have never possessed the strength, but I am not fool enough to deny the truth.
Ah, now, but you said, didn't you? You said it wasn't your argument. On the hill, that's what you said, gabbled Archie, excited to have caught Samad out on something. So what if this bloke does whatever he does? You said that was our problem, us, in the West. That's what you said.
Dr. Sick, watery eye blood now streaming like rivers, was still being held by the hair by Samad and was gagging now on his own tongue.
Watch out, you're choking him, said Archie.
What of it? Yelled Samad into the echoless landscape. Men like him believe that living organs should answer to design. They worship the science of the body, but not who has given it to us. He's a Nazi, the worst kind.
But you said, Archie pressed on, determined to make his point. You said that was nothing to do with you, not your argument. If anyone in this jeep should have a score to settle with Mad Jerry here,
French, he's French.
All right, French.
Well, if anyone's got a score to settle, it'd probably have to be me. It's England's future we've been fighting for England, you know, said Archie, searching his brain.
Democracy and Sunday dinners and promenades and piers and bangers and mash and the things that are ours, not yours.
Precisely, said Samad.
You what?
You must do it, Archie.
Archie, Coco.
Jones,
your destiny is staring you in the face, and here you are slapping the salami, said Samad with a nasty laugh in his voice, and still holding the doctor by the hair across the front seat.
Steady on, said Archie, trying to keep an eye on the road as Samad bent the doctor's neck almost to breaking point.
Look, I'm not saying that he doesn't deserve to die.
Then do it. Do it!
But why is it so bloody important to you that I do it? You know, I've never killed a man. Not like that. Not face to face. A man shouldn't die in a car. I can't do that.
Jones, it is simply a question of what you will do when the chips are down. This is a question that interests me a great deal. Call tonight the practical application of a long-held belief. An experiment, if you like.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I want to know what kind of man you are, Jones. I want to know what you are capable of. Are you a coward, Jones?
Archie brought the jeep to a shattering halt.
You're bloody asking for it, you are.
You don't stand for anything, Jones, continued Samad. Not for a faith, not for a politics, not even for your country. How your lot ever conquered my lot is a bloody mystery. You're a cipher, no?
A what?
And an idiot.
What are you going to tell your children when they ask who you are, what you are? Will you know? Will you ever know?
What are you that's so bloody fantastic?
I'm a Muslim, and a man, and a son, and a believer. I will survive the last days.
You're a bloody drunkard, and you're drugged. You're drugged tonight, aren't you?
I am a Muslim, and a man, and a son, and a believer. I will survive the last days, Samad repeated, as if it were a chant.
And what the bloody hell does that mean?
As he shouted, Archie made a grab for Dr. Sick, pulled his now blood-covered face near his own until their noses touched.
You, Archie barked, you're coming with me.
I would, but monsieur,
the doctor held up his handcuffed wrists. Archie wrestled them open with the rusty key, pulled the doctor out of the jeep, and started walking away from the road into the darkness, a gun pointed at the base point of Dr. Marc-Pierre Perret's cranium.
Are you going to kill me, boy? Asked Dr. Sick as they walked.
Looks like it done it, said Archie.
May I plead for my life?
If you like, said Archie, pushing him on.
Sitting in the jeep, some 5 minutes later, Samad heard a shot ring out. It made him jump. He slapped dead an insect that had been winding its way around his wrist, looking for enough flesh to bite. Lifting his head, he saw in front of him that Archie was returning, bleeding and limping badly, made visible, then invisible, illuminated, obscured, as he wound in and out of the headlights. He looked his tender age, the lamps making his blonde hair translucent, his moon-shaped face lit up like a big baby, head first, entering life.
Samad, 1984-1857. The cricket test. Which side do they cheer for? Are you still looking back to where you came from? Or where you are? Norman Tebbit. 6. The Temptation of Samad Iqbal. Children. Samad had caught children like a disease. Yes, he had sired two of them willingly as a man can, but he had not bargained for this other thing. This thing that no one tells you about. This thing of knowing children. For 40-odd years, traveling happily along life's highway, Samad had been unaware that dotted along that road, in the creche facilities of each service station, there lived a subclass of society, a mewling, puking underclass. He knew nothing of them, and it did not concern him. Then suddenly, in the early 80s, he became infected with children, other people's children. Children who were friends of his children, and then their friends. Then children in children's programs on children's TV. By 1984, at least 30% of his social and cultural circle was under the age of 9. And this all led inevitably to the position he now found himself in. He was a parent governor. By a strange process of symmetry, being a parent governor perfectly mirrors the process of becoming a parent. It starts innocently, casually. You turn up at the annual spring fair full of beans, help with the raffle tickets, because the pretty red-haired music teacher asks you to, and win a bottle of whiskey. All school raffles are fixed. And before you know where you are, you're turning up at the weekly school council meetings, organizing concerts, discussing plans for a new music department, donating funds for the rejuvenation of the water fountains. You're implicated in the school. You're involved in it. Sooner or later, you stop dropping your child at the school gates. You start following them in. Put your hand down. I will not put it down. Put it down, please. Let go of me, Samad. Why are you so eager to mortify me? Put it down. I have an opinion. I have a right to an opinion. And I have a right to express that opinion. Yes, but do you have to express it so often? This was the hissed exchange between Samad and Alsana Iqbal as they sat at the back of a Wednesday school governor's meeting in early July 84. Alsana trying her best to force Samad's determined left arm back to his side. Get off, woman! Alsana put her two tiny hands to his wrist and tried applying a Chinese burn. Samad Mia, can't you understand that I am only trying to save you from yourself? As the covert wrestling continued, the chairwoman, Katie Miniver, a lanky white divorcee with tight jeans, extremely curly hair and buck teeth, tried desperately to avoid Samad's eyes. She silently cursed Mrs. Hansen, the fat lady just behind him, who was speaking about the woodworm in the school orchard, inadvertently making it impossible to pretend that Samad's persistent raised hand had gone unseen. Sooner or later, she was going to have to let him speak. In between nodding at Mrs. Hansen, she snatched a surreptitious glance at the minutes, which the secretary, Mrs. Killani, was scribbling away on her left. She wanted to check that it was not her imagination.